Abortion care providers challenge Indiana's abortion ban. Tom McDermott's poll shows a close Senate race, plus equity in electric vehicle charging plans, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 2nd, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana abortion care providers are trying to stop the state's near-total abortion ban from taking effect. A lawsuit filed in state court Tuesday says the ban violates the Indiana Constitution. Planned Parenthood, Whole Woman's Health, and All Options Pregnancy Resource Center are Indiana's primary providers of abortion care. They'll be forced to stop providing that care September 15th, when the state's abortion ban is set to take effect. They're now challenging the ban in court. The law limits abortion to only hospitals and surgical centers owned by hospitals, and specifically bans abortion clinics. The healthcare organizations argue that's unlawful discrimination under the state constitution. They also argue that an exception in the bill, allowing abortions when the serious health or life of the pregnant person is at risk, is unconstitutionally vague. They allege a conflict about when the exception can be used. One provision suggests it's at any time during pregnancy. Another suggests it's limited to 22 weeks of pregnancy. The providers want the court to at least temporarily halt the law before it takes effect.
Yes.
Will this lawsuit halt Indiana's abortion ban? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Greg Stowers, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, in light of this lawsuit, what would you say to Hoosiers who are wondering, on both sides of the issue, if Indiana's abortion ban will take effect September 15th?
Well, we're certainly going to have to wait for the court to weigh in, but you know, there are a few certainties in life, and the ACLU filing a lawsuit on the abortion law is one of them. And so now, you know, opposing sides can make their arguments, and then the court will bring clarity.
Yeah. Certainly the ACLU has filed a lot of lawsuits, as Jennifer points out, over the years, over anti-abortion laws that Indiana has passed, but they've always been in federal court, because as long as Roe v. Wade was at the time the standing precedent, they were, with almost like complete certainty, going to be knocked down, and lawmakers generally knew that. This one, it feels like much more of a roll of the dice, doesn't it?
A little bit. I think it's, you know, I want to leave it up to the lawyers. I want to leave it up to the courts, obviously. But there were 50 years ahead of this where my colleagues on the right were advocating to get this, to get rid of this, and came to a point where we'll see what happens on September 15th, but I think it is sort of a roll of the dice.
There's been a little bit of litigation in the past in state courts, very, very little that we could find, that has to do with abortion law. I think the AP found that a case out of 2004, the state appellate court ruled that there was a right to privacy in the Indiana Constitution and that abortion rights were a part of that right. It went up to the state Supreme Court, who upheld the law but said, well, this is a Roe v. Wade issue. We don't have to decide this on the state constitution issue. And so we don't know what the highest court in the state thinks about abortion when it comes to the state constitution. So regardless of whether or not the ban takes effect September 15th, it'll certainly be appealed up, presumably. So it feels like we're going to get some, as Jennifer pointed out, some clarity about this issue one way or the other.
Yeah, eventually. I would say the big question at the beginning is whether they'll do an injunction while we debate that. The privacy part of the lawsuit, and speaking to a few lawyers that I know, seems a little bit more like the weakest argument they have. There are two other angles. The argument, one part points out a contradiction in the law for the life of the mother and fatal fetal anomalies. The other part has to do with treating abortion clinics differently than hospitals. That's the whole option of, you know, they took any right to do any abortion, even medication abortions, away from clinics and put them basically only with hospitals, which is a huge shift in policy. And so there are some equal privileges arguments there, and we'll see all three of them.
Obviously, in the past, when groups like the ACLU would file a lawsuit challenging an abortion law, and they got halted or not, the stakes were, are there going to be more restrictions? Are there going to be a few more barriers? Stakes here are much bigger, to the point of, where can you even get the the abortions that are still legal, which is a vanishingly small number of places under the law, and potentially how restricted is abortion access, period, not just in location, but even what kinds you can get. So the stakes are much higher this time, but does that really change? I mean, will that change ultimately how the argument plays out in court, do you think?
You would want to assume that it has no bearing on the decisions of the folks in the judicial branch. But they're human beings, last time I checked. They know what's going on. They talk to people. They read newspapers. They watch
newscasts. They live in the world.
They live in the world. So it's unrealistic, I think, to assume that that their thinking is not shaped in some fashion by sort of I'm not saying political impact in terms of partisan gain, but just the politics in terms of societal impact and repercussions, not even in a partisan arena.
I mean, and that is also some of the argument here.
Well, and that's the whole issue of behind seeking an injunction is if you can prove irreparable harm,
right,
then you know you have a bit of a leg to stand on.
And I think when you
it's arguably never been more clear, even in an abortion case, than it is in this one. Yeah.
And this is something of a rarity, as you pointed out, in Indiana for state courts. It's not unprecedented, but it is a rarity. But we're seeing this unfold in states across the country where, again, the issues may be subtly different, as you would expect, because you're dealing with state constitutions and state statute. But courts are weighing in, and we have seen a lot of courts in conservative states put the brakes on these kinds of measures and say, let's take a break, because the stakes are high, and once a lot of these, if these clinics do close, it's hard to get them back up and running again. So I don't think it's at all beyond the realm of possibility that the court would say, let's all take a deep breath here. There's a lot at stake, and let's make sure, because of the inconsistency in the statute or the contradiction, I think that probably is maybe the most compelling
that part
component.
Is just easily to fixed.
It is easily fixed, but also a reason to temporarily halt
right,
the law, potentially.
Right.
Well, we'll find out, presumably, in just a few weeks' time. A poll from Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Tom McDermott's campaign, released to the Indy Star this week, suggests Indiana's U.S. Senate race could be a lot closer than many expected. The Indy Star story says the poll conducted for McDermott by polling firm Change Research shows 45% of those surveyed say they will vote for incumbent Republican Senator Todd Young, while 42% say they will vote for McDermott, with a margin of error of around 2.5%. Another 13% are undecided. More than 2,000 people were surveyed, and Libertarian candidate James Siniak wasn't included in the poll. The Young campaign reportedly took issue with the methodology, primarily centered on the fact that the poll was conducted online. Greg Stowers, how seriously should we take a poll that comes out of one of any candidate's campaign?
Short answer is you got to take it seriously. I think from a campaign perspective, polls are there from a strategy standpoint, right? You want to make sure that you're adhering to what the numbers say. But from a standpoint of the reputableness of the poll, you have the Indy Star backing it up. You had two college professors backing it up. You know, Change Research is a reputable poll that is out there. So I think it's certainly going to incite the base a little bit, and I think that's part of the goal.
Those of us who cover these sorts of things always take polls coming out of any campaign with a grain of salt. But even with that, are you surprised that any poll that seems legitimate, as this one does seem to, as much as it can, are you at all surprised that it's even this close?
It's not this close. I mean, it doesn't seem legitimate to me at all. There are a couple of big problems with this. I mean, first of all, it's all online, part of it generated through Facebook advertising. We are not to a point yet where all online surveys are reliable. You don't have people on the phone screening respondents. And this firm does not have a good track record in Indiana. In the governor's race in 2020, they were off by 18 points. They were also off significantly in Congressman Spartz's district. So we've seen problems in their methodology and the numbers that they've reported in Indiana. So I think perhaps if they added a it's an unscientific but fun poll the way others do, that might
give it,
be
yeah, give it a couple
a
minutes.
Little more to accept. But no, I mean, I don't think it's anywhere close to that. I think that Senator Young has a much larger lead. And with $7 million and going up on television, I think this week, he's going to have an even bigger lead. You know, but we're talking double digits.
That I think is the conventional has been the conventional wisdom about this race. I don't think, regardless of who Tom McDermott is, I think everybody just assumed that Todd Young, with all his money and with the advantage that not only incumbents but Republicans have in Indiana, he had a big lead. Does a poll like this, whether it's flawed or not, does a poll like this being out there excite people who might have not been paying attention to this race to go, oh, maybe we should take Tom McDermott seriously?
Yeah, it actually does, I think. And it probably excites two camps, both camps, and for different reasons. If it's, yes, Todd Young's campaign can sort of dismiss it for the reasons that have been pointed out here, but still in the back of their minds, it's still sort of unnerving to say, well, gee, it could be this close. So then there's that sort of desire to redouble their efforts and really focus more on getting out voters and sort of the grassroots aspect of this, because I'm sure they already have the air campaign and with the $7 million taken care of. But this is about the little things, getting people to the polls.
And for Republican voters themselves, if they were, you know, the worst thing that can happen to an incumbent's campaign is everybody assuming they're going to win and then nobody
right.
bothering to show up.
And then it also certainly gives, I think, some bit of buoyancy to the McDermott campaign and some sense that it could be close. So it, I think it's a boost for both. And I also would give a caution again. We look around the country and you can't make apples to apples comparisons because every district is different. No, I mean, this is a statewide race, but still, we'll look at other federal races. You had the 19th New York special election this week where the Republican was, by all polls, was supposed to win, didn't. We've seen other instances.
The Alaska
we saw. Now, it wasn't a candidate, a race in the traditional sense, but in Kansas we saw the vote on abortion. So I am wondering, and certainly the McDermott campaign would hope that this is the case, I am wondering if, in fact, as some Democrats have suggested, that Roe-vember, as in Roe v. Wade, if that is such a potent force in terms of motivating voters who might not have engaged in the past, or even new voters who are coming out the sidelines, yeah. So to speak.
I want to ask one other thing about this poll, which is, as we pointed out in the story, they didn't include the Libertarian candidate. Now, I get if it was a Todd Young campaign poll, you might not want to include the Libertarian candidate because the conventional wisdom is a Libertarian candidate is going to pull votes from the Republican. And there are certainly been more of a movement, I would say, in the last few years here in Indiana of people unhappy with the mainstream Republican Party or the Libertarian Party trying to gain more traction. I don't know if that will play out in this election, but why would you not want to put that person in this poll?
Yeah, I mean, if you had included the Libertarian candidate, it probably would have made the numbers look even better for McDermott.
Yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure why they left him out. You're going all to the you're putting the money into the poll. You might as well include
the candidates. Yeah, it's not like they're charging per word.
Right.
At least I hope they're not charging per word.
Good pollsters would do that.
Yeah. All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. Hey, we just heard that somewhere. This week's question, who will win Indiana's U.S. Senate race? Todd Young, Tom McDermott, or the Libertarian James Ciniak? Put him in my poll. Last week's question, do you support President Biden's plan to forgive up to $10,000 in student debt for those earning less than $125,000? 69% of you say yes, 31% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, an alliance demands the federal government reject Indiana's electric vehicle charging plan due to equity concerns. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports it also asked U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg to tour places where it says the chargers should be placed and see what opportunities it could open up for those communities.
The Indiana Alliance for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion for Electric Vehicle Infrastructure and Economic Opportunities says, under the state's plan, few chargers would be placed in racially or ethnically diverse communities. But it's important they get a seat at the table. Lionel Rush is the president of the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance in Indianapolis.
The highways tore through the historically black neighborhoods, destroying homes and businesses, uprooting families and community, poisoning the air that we breathe.
Among other things, the alliance wants the state to commit to placing chargers in racially and ethnically diverse communities and at black-owned businesses. It also wants NDOT to create an equity advisory board and commit to hiring and training a diverse workforce for the EV projects. So far, the group says NDOT hasn't responded to any of its requests.
Nikki Kelly, should the federal government step in to address these concerns if the state isn't being responsive?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's their place. It's technically their money, so they probably could. I thought what was interesting is there were sort of two levels of concern in this. The one is where they're literally being placed. They're basically sort of more affluent, you know, places. And then the second
arguably
was
where electric vehicles are now.
True.
But the point is, this is not for the next 5 years, it's for the next 50 years.
Yes, mm-hmm. So you got to think beyond just where we are at right now.
Yeah.
And then the second issue is the whole advisory situation and who they got comments from and who were on the board is just, there really was very little attempt to, I think, get the minority communities involved. And so I think between the two of them, we'll see if Secretary Buttigieg steps in.
Our reporter Rebecca Field did a story about these exact concerns almost 2 months ago when they were first raised by this alliance. And when I talked to her about it last week, knowing this event was coming up, I said, do you expect anything to change with this new press conference? And she said, I mean, no, because the concerns are the same, because after the plan was initially rolled out, nothing has changed. So why do you think the state isn't being responsive here?
You know, I don't know. I think the market eventually will get there because these vehicles will become more and more popular. We saw what California is doing, and you know, like it or not, as California goes, so goes a lot of the automotive manufacturing industry. For obvious reasons, that's a huge chunk of the market. So this may be upon us even faster than we had thought in terms of a pervasive sort of market, if not saturation, at least a good percentage of vehicles needing these kinds of charging stations. And that will force it to be in lots of areas, not just where there seems to be the demand right now. Because again, it's a fluid, this is a moving target, obviously. Why is the state not being more responsive? I think they're probably thinking, you know, where's the demand now? And it comes down simply to that, you know, where, if you, any kind of assessment, you know, where should we put firehouses? Where should we put, you know, look at data, where are the fires? And you put the facilities in those locations. And I think that's part of it. But also, you know, you have a philosophy, maybe more so pronounced at the state level than at the federal level, where it's not, you know, this is a perfect example of where the market and demand should drive the placement of these types of things. It's not social engineering. It's not using government dollars to engineer an outcome, although that's what government does all the time.
Between being practical and being aspirational.
Right, right. And that's a debate that goes on. You know, should we have a flat tax or should we use it to encourage home ownership or you know, charity for valuable nonprofits or for college education? You know, this is a debate that's probably 100 plus years old.
In terms of where the market will eventually go, and talking about this is not about the next few years, it's about the next several decades. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act, the latest federal spending bill that passed recently, includes a new federal tax credit for electric vehicles that, for the first time, instead of saying, okay, we'll give you some money when you file your taxes next year after you bought one of these vehicles, which doesn't really help people with the cost of a car. Instead, now you apply that credit at the purchase. So you can bring the cost of one of these down, I think, up to $7,000 because of this new program. These things are already getting cheaper. The federal government's making them a little more cost effective. We need to be thinking, you know, a little more aspirationally, but a little more practically too, about where this is going to be for the long term, don't we?
Well, I think so. I think there's a balance that has to be struck here. You know, the state says that, you know, they've followed the law in preparing the plan, and meeting the overall goals of having stations, you know, along the highways so that you're kind of reducing the anxiety for range, that people would be able to travel distances. And that's the primary, you know, primary kind of focus there. And then also they'll say that there is coverage. You know, their counter to this is that there is great coverage where nearly everyone is within, you know, 35 miles of a charging station. But at the same time, I think, you know, we need to have all voices here, and this, and we need to make sure that this transition is right, and that everyone's going to have the opportunity. And if we want more people to be, you know, driving electric vehicles, then we have to make sure that we're putting the places out, the pieces out there for them to see that and want to do that. So, you know, all of these things are a process, and I'm hopeful that at the end of the day, it will be good for everyone. And frankly, also, Indiana is just seeing a lot of investment from, you know, the EV world, yeah. Right? And we have yeah. Stellantis and potentially this battery center in, yeah. in Carlisle. And so let's really embrace this time and make sure it's for everybody.
Even if the plan were exactly the same as it is right now, but folks who represent these communities had a bigger seat at the table, would that automatically have made this whole situation better?
I mean, the hope is yes. You know, I just don't see the state being as intentional as they could be. You know, when we think about electronic vehicles, I think it's also important to think about environmental justice, as we think about equity, as we think about you know, exactly like the next 50 years ahead. And you know, I'm not really sure, you know, why the state isn't moving as quickly as it could be, but. We'll see. Well,
don't assume yeah. everybody in the state, though, is unified in support of electric vehicles, because as we saw before, the state used to give an even bigger incentive, but then there was a push in the General Assembly, what, session or two back, where they're not paying gas taxes. So we're not only going to do away with the benefit, we're going to put a surcharge on electric vehicles.
All right. There's no evidence that Indiana taxpayer dollars are being invested using what's known as environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, considerations. But Attorney General Todd Rokita says he wants to assure Hoosiers that's true. ESG investing is a growing practice in which investors consider the environmental and social impacts of their investments. Several conservative-led states have taken steps to ban it when it comes to investing public dollars. Attorney General Todd Rokita says the Indiana Public Retirement System, INPRS, is already banned from incorporating ESG investing strategies under state law.
We all deserve assurance that state retirement funds are being invested solely for financial interests.
Rokita says there's no evidence INPRS is using ESG practices, but he says the state does use outside investment firms to manage its funds, and the Republican AG says he's investigating whether those firms employ that investment strategy. There's evidence that states banning firms that use ESG investing have cost taxpayer dollars by limiting competition and increasing borrowing costs. John Schwanis, what problem exactly is Todd Rokita purporting to address?
Maybe he's addressing the faction of the party that eats this kind of stuff up, and maybe he hasn't had enough headlines this week on topics that don't really have anything to do with his office. I mean, this is a pattern we've seen. Todd Rokita just, and whatever's fashionable around the country, is it critical race theory? Is it, you know, is it parent rights? Are parents somehow deprived of an opportunity to weigh in on their students' interests in the public schools? Is this, I mean, every week we could come up with the Todd Rokita topic of the week. And as a practical matter, it seems designed to just, do what we're doing right here, which is talk about it and get people worked up.
I want to talk a little bit about how he did this. I'm not going to call it a press conference, how he did this event. It seems like that's what he wants to do going forward. Explain a little bit, and is that a problem?
Yeah. Really quick, I just want to note, he did at least, this was a question that a state lawmaker asked for an advisory opinion
That's
on.
True.
So he didn't at least pull it out of total thin air. But anyway, secondly, yeah. So normally, you know, we all go to a press conference, you sit in the same room, you get called on, you shout your question, you answer the question.
You can respond to something he
Correct.
Already said.
This was different. They live streamed it on Facebook, and they told reporters, you had to email in your written questions before, by the way, before we didn't know what was going to be discussed, or while it was going on. And then they look at the questions and choose which ones to ask him. I mean, it's a very, it's just not a good situation, because think back when the governor was doing COVID stuff, at least when you raised your hand on the Zoom, they didn't know what question was coming. That lets them pick and choose so that some of the harder ones don't get, he doesn't have to answer them. It's just a lack of accountability.
We worked out a way where we were able to come up with follow-up questions that we could ask when we were called on, and even coordinated with, okay, if you're going to get called on today, we all need this question answered. None of that was possible. Overall, though, is this kind of what we should expect from Todd Rokita's leadership in that office?
It's been the Christopher Columbusing of woke since everything started. I remember back in the day, the phrase "stay woke" was something that was kind of cool, and now it isn't. And these boogeyman tactics don't really help Hoosiers at all.
I guess we'll see how often we talk about. Feels like the same kind of issue all over again with Todd Rokita, but I imagine he'll be thrilled. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Greg Stowers, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelist. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.